I'm Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Before Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning earned notoriety for their theft of U.S. government secrets, there was Brian Patrick Regan. This hour, my co-host Nathan Sterner delves into the bizarre story of this lesser-known American spy. Regan used his position in a U.S. intelligence agency to steal huge amounts of secret government data and tried to sell it off to foreign governments. He was brought down in part because of his dyslexia. A new book on the case is called The Spy Who Couldn't Spell. Nathan talks with the author in the first part of the hour, and then Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me here in Studio A with her review of American Hero, a dark comedy about a family trying to keep its small business afloat. It'll be an interesting hour, and it all starts right after the news.
Welcome to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Tom Hall. Today is Thursday, so later this hour, we'll bring you our weekly theater review. Critic J. Wynn Russick will stop by to chat with producer Rob Sivak about American Hero, playing now at Rep Stage in Columbia. For the first part of our program, we'll explore the story of Brian Patrick Regan. He was the first person to face the death penalty on espionage charges since the Rosenbergs back in the 1950s. It was the late 90s and early 2000s that Regan stole huge amounts of top-secret government data and tried to sell it off to foreign governments. He didn't have any ideological connection to those governments, nor any real hatred of America. His crime was more about money. He was facing a crushing load of debt. He also seemed to want to prove that he was smarter than his co-workers, to himself, if nobody else. His plan was ingenious. He encrypted his data in codes that proved impossible to crack, and it took lots of clever steps to ensure that he would not be caught. But he was caught in the end, in part because he made some careless mistakes, and in part because he was dyslexic. Udijit Bhattacharjee has detailed the case in a new book called The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, and he's on the line from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Nathan. Glad to be here.
And we also welcome your questions. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email to midday@wypr.org. So start by giving us a little background on Brian Patrick Regan. How did he get into a position to steal the government secrets he did, and how much did he end up stealing?
Brian Regan was an Air Force signals analyst, and he had worked for the Air Force starting in 1980. In 1995, he was assigned to the National Reconnaissance Office, which is one of the most secretive of the United States' intelligence agencies. It's the agency that manages all of the spy satellites that the U.S. has in space. So Brian Regan had access to thousands of classified images, top-secret documents, because he had a top-secret security clearance, and because his job required him to access some of these documents. But starting in late 1998, early 1999, he decided that he was going to commit espionage and that he was going to cash in on the nation's secrets. And so he started downloading just thousands of pages of classified documents off of the government servers, which he had access to just by virtue of his clearance. And strangely enough, this was sort of the same technique that Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning used many years later. So Brian Regan was sort of a pioneer in using digital access to steal classified information.
And nobody noticed that he was stealing all this stuff.
No. For months and months, he squirreled away this information. He first downloaded it. Then he started printing it out, just hundreds of pages of documents. He first hoarded it at the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. And then he started to smuggle these documents out of the NRO headquarters in Chantilly, Virginia. And he took them home. He started sorting them. He started packaging them. And then he prepared for his next step.
What could foreign governments have done with the data that he stole?
Well, foreign governments could have done a lot of harm to the United States, and they could have neutralized quite a bit of the U.S.'s technological and military superiority. So the U.S. relies on a lot of sophisticated intelligence gathering capability in order to prevail in conflicts with other countries. And one of the main sources of intelligence is spy satellites that collect both photographs as well as signals intelligence about military facilities around the world. And so by disclosing exactly what the United States knew or knows about these facilities, about missile systems, about airfields and so on, Brian Regan would have compromised national security to a great extent. And then, hostile countries would have used that information to sort of relocate their airfields, to figure out the periodicity of the various satellites that were spying on these facilities, and the U.S. would have lost out in its intelligence gathering capacity, and that would have presented a direct and clear threat to warfighters overseas.
Now, as you mentioned, no one noticed he was downloading all this stuff. No one noticed that he was walking out with these thousands of pages of data from his offices. We found out about this because he was trying to sell it off, and we found out about that because we got a tip, right?
Indeed. So for months and months, he was able to keep this a secret. You know, he was able to easily move all this information out of the NRO and start to store it in his basement. And it was only after he sent these anonymous letters to a few embassies of Middle Eastern countries, notably to the Libyan consulate in New York, that the FBI got wind of his plan. But of course, at the time, all that the FBI got was a tip in the form of these intercepted letters that he had sent. And the letters were encrypted. They were sort of in three parts. One was the encoded letter. The second was a code book with words in it. And then the third was an instruction manual for breaking out the letter. And that's how the FBI sort of got on to the case. But of course, it would be several months before they'd figure out who this person was.
And he sent it in three letters because he wanted to make sure that if one of the letters was grabbed, they wouldn't be able to figure out what the other letters contained.
That's right. He employed what's known as COMSEC, in military parlance, communications security. And so his hope was that even if one of these letters got intercepted by his own government, without the other two, the government wouldn't know what this letter meant, and he would get away with it. So it was sort of a layer of security. But little did he know that the FBI would get a hold of all three parts.
And that's because we had an informant in the Libyan consulate in New York, which is where he sent these.
Yes, I don't get into that in the story too much because I don't know the circumstances in which the FBI got it. But yes, it came via an informant. Now, whether that informant was indeed the person who received this mail at the consulate, we don't know. If it was somebody who just happened to have access into the Libyan consulate, that could have been it. But yes, it was an informant.
But we needed to keep that access that we had to the consulate secret. So we, the FBI, had to figure out how to get to Regan without letting him know that we had gotten this information. And so basically, the FBI picked up where the Libyan consulate would have had it wanted to get in touch with him.
Yes, and in fact, in the book I describe how the FBI sort of had a trained Middle East expert, somebody who spoke Arabic and could respond to a phone call should Brian Regan actually call? And so first the FBI placed these ads, used car ads in the Washington Post, to draw the attention of Regan, because that was the way that Regan, who was still not known to the FBI at the time, the sender of these letters had proposed communicating through that route. And so the FBI did all of the things that he had asked the Libyans to do, but they struck out. They weren't able to figure out who the person was, because Brian Regan never got in touch.
He decided that he was done looking at that venue. It had taken so too long, so he tried to sell the secrets other ways. From the documents that we did get from the Libyan consulate, that was where the FBI sort of narrowed it down and figured out that it was Regan. And this was in part because of his dyslexia, because as your book is titled, he was the spy who could not spell.
That's correct, Nathan. He had gone to great lengths to cover his tracks and to keep his communications anonymous. However, what he hadn't done was run a spell check on all of the coded words that he had used. And so the code book, which contained all the words that the letter was then to be substituted with, contained, just dozens of misspellings. And so right off the bat, the FBI knew that they were looking for a bad speller, possibly somebody who might be dyslexic, and also somebody who might lack some judgment in terms of planning out this kind of a plot.
Someone later referred to him as Mr. 80%, because 80% of his schemes were absolutely brilliant, would not have been cracked at all. And then there was the 20% where he didn't bother to run the spell checker or made other just very careless mistakes.
That's what makes Brian Regan so fascinating to me, and that's why I was drawn to the story, because he was brilliant in many ways. He was a pioneer in some ways, which we now know because, Snowden and Manning came along many years afterwards. Not to say that Snowden and Manning were traitors necessarily in the same way that Regan was, but he was, he saw the opportunity. He saw that he could access information in this way, and that was brilliant. I mean, in hindsight, it certainly seems brilliant. There were several other things he did, including the codes that he invented to hide the secrets that he stole. And that too was very, very smart, but he would do really stupid things too. Like, he used public libraries to go and do some of his preparation for espionage. He was looking for the addresses of various embassies, Middle Eastern embassies in Europe at one time. And he was doing it at a library so that the government wouldn't find out. But then when he got up from the terminal that he was using, he failed to close the browser. And so there were FBI agents who were watching him inside the library, and all they had to do was keep hitting the back button in order to recreate his entire browsing history. And that evidence later was produced in court and used to prosecute him.
We think about spies as people who are working for foreign governments or people who have some sort of ideology that has led them to steal government secrets. But that wasn't Regan.
No, Regan was purely driven by his financial distress. He was in a lot of debt.
How much debt?
He was in, he owed, I think, over $120,000 just in credit card payments. And so I'm not counting all the debt that he owed, in terms of house mortgage and car payments and so on. And so that doesn't look like a huge amount of debt. I mean, there are people who have been able to get out from under that kind of debt. There are lots of people. But Brian Regan, from his childhood, sort of came to see the world as an adversary. He didn't really trust that he could be helped. He thought he could only rely on himself in order to get out of trouble. And I think it was this personality trait that made him so vulnerable to the bad thoughts that entered his head in the late 1990s, which led him down this path of treason.
And he ended up asking for, what, $13 million or something?
Yes, and in fact, the FBI agents who finally arrested him, and after he was convicted, they asked him why he had decided on that figure, because, to be honest with you, that's a really big amount, and no spy in American history, nobody working for the Russians or anybody else, has even gotten a fraction of that kind of money. But Brian Regan's answer was that, you know, he wanted to pay off his own debts. He also wanted to pay off the debts of his brothers and sisters. He came from a large family. He wanted to secure the financial future of his children. And so he had sort of done the math on the back of an envelope and come up with that number.
And that's what he was asking for. We know that he asked, he sent that letter to Libya. Who else did he send that letter to, asking for the money in exchange for secrets?
Investigators discovered later on that he had also sent those letters to the Iraqis. And in fact, he had also sent the same letters to the Iranians. I don't know about any additional countries, but those three are a definite.
And he was looking at China, too, as maybe a possible...
He was looking at China, yes. It's not clear if he had sent letters to the Chinese, but, you know, he was getting frustrated because he wasn't really finding a buyer, despite all of his efforts. He, in fact, made a trip to Europe in June of 2001 and knocked on the doors of the Libyan embassy there in Switzerland, trying to market himself. But he didn't succeed because he just lacked the finesse, and he came across as kind of a bumbling idiot and was thrown out of the embassy. So after that, you know, when he returned to the U.S., he started making, you know, other plans. So he was all about Plan B, Plan C, Plan D. That's how he had led his life, and that's the kind of philosophy that he implemented in his espionage attempt as well.
That's Udijit Bhattacharjee. His book is called The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, A Dyslexic Traitor, An Unbreakable Code, and the FBI's Hunt for America's Stolen Secrets. More on the story of Brian Regan after a break. Stay with us. You're listening to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. We're talking about The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, a new book by Udijit Bhattacharjee. The spy in question, Brian Regan, who stole thousands of pages of top-secret government documents and tried to sell them to foreign governments like those in Iraq and Libya. Once he got all of these documents, he compiled them into little packages that he thought would be of the most interest to specific governments, to Iraq and to Libya. What did he do with all of those packets of information once he stole them? He wanted to make sure that he wouldn't be caught red-handed with them.
That's right. So the next step in his operation was to sort all of this information, like you said, and then he wrapped them up in garbage bags, put them in Tupperware containers, and made these packages that were sort of customized for the specific governments that he was targeting. And then he went out to two state parks, one in Virginia, the Pocahontas State Park, and one in Maryland, the Patapsco Valley State Park.
Just a stone's throw from Baltimore.
That's right. And he went there, and he went there with a shovel. You know, he went off the hiking trails, and he looked for some soft earth, and he started digging. And then he buried these packages, 19 packages in all, in the two state parks. And then he wrote down the GPS coordinates of these hiding locations. And then he encrypted those coordinates, turned them into a code, so that all he had with him were these sheets of paper with some letters and numbers on them. This was his way of protecting himself. If he thought, if I ever get caught, nobody will find out what these things mean.
And once he eventually did get caught, no one was able to figure out what these things meant.
Exactly right. In fact, most spy stories would come to an end with the arrest of the spy in question. But not in this case. In this case, Brian Regan was able to keep up his cat and mouse game with the investigators for long after his arrest. And in fact, it was only after his conviction and sentencing that the FBI was able to finally resolve those codes and figure out where the secrets were buried.
So the original plan was to give the GPS coordinates to the foreign governments once they sent him the money. Then, once he was arrested, the plan became to blackmail the U.S. government in order to get their data back.
Yes, the audacity of Brian Regan is really mind-boggling because his plan, as you rightly described, was to simply hand over these locations to whichever government took him up on his offer so that they could go and dig it up themselves. And that way, his plan was to continue to remain anonymous, although once he made that trip to the Libyan embassy in Europe, he'd kind of modified his position on that, and he was willing to not be completely anonymous. But anyway, his plan was to not have to hand over these packages physically himself. He'd be out of the picture. But once he got arrested, he decided that the government still didn't know exactly what he had done. And the government had an inkling that he had stolen secrets, but they didn't know how many. They didn't know exactly what. They were still in the process of sort of reconstructing all of his history at the NRO, his history of downloading and printing things. It was a massive sort of digital forensics exercise that was ongoing at the time. And of course, they didn't know where he had hidden these documents. And he thought, well, all I have to do is to threaten the government that, look, I've got stuff that's hidden out there. And in fact, that's what he said through his lawyer. He said, I've got stuff buried out there that could start a war. And this was his way of asking for a lenient prison sentence. And of course, the government was shocked to hear this, but ultimately Defense Department officials and Justice Department officials decided that this would set an extremely bad precedent, and they decided to prosecute him to the full extent of the law. In fact, they sought the death penalty against him precisely because of this blackmailing tactic.
Because this sort of thing cannot happen again.
Yes, absolutely not. I mean, this was, if this had gone down, then it would have set such a bad bad precedent for other intelligence analysts and other people with security clearances, planning espionage, that the government would have had a major problem on their hands in the years to come.
But they didn't want to execute him, even though they sought the death penalty for him, because they really wanted to get this data back. There were the packets that he had hidden for foreign governments. I think I recall that most of the information that he had hidden in the Patapsco Valley State Park was stuff he was using mostly as an insurance plan, just in case he got caught. And then there was some stuff he stole that even he thought was too dangerous to be out there.
Yes, and this is the complicated character of Brian Regan on display. There's a scene in the book where I describe how, once he went out to Pocahontas, he rented this motel room, cheap motel room, to stay and do the rest of his hiding operation. And he decided, he sorted through some of the documents that he had, and he was repackaging some of them, and he decided that there were some that were so sensitive that they would really, really hurt the United States, and they would cause a catastrophe, for global peace. I don't know exactly what these documents were. I was never told, but he decided that he was going to destroy these documents instead of burying them, and so he didn't want to sell them. He tried to first flush some of these documents down the toilet. You know, once again, the worst spy in the world title comes to mind. When the toilet got clogged, he just kind of had to pull all of the documents out, and then he put them in the bathtub of the motel room, and he ran the water until he was able to mulch these little stacks of documents, and then he took them out and threw them into a dumpster. So it was as if he had, you know, a little stirring of conscience that kind of interfered with his espionage plan right at the last minute.
When he finally was caught, they'd been surveilling him for a while. They had figured out who he was months before. But when he finally was caught, they didn't have any really, at least initially, didn't have any really good evidence they could use at trial against him. All they had were these cryptic codes that they were unable to crack. Eventually, what ended up turning the point was some data that might have been deleted from a computer he had, and his own defense attorney sort of tipped them off that it was there.
You're right, Nathan. I described earlier how the FBI got onto the case because of the tip that they got from the informant they had in the Libyan consulate. But they could not bring this informant to testify in court. And they knew that all that the defense would have to do in court to prove that Brian was innocent, or at least to disprove that he might be guilty, was to cast doubt on this initial information and just say, who knows where this information came from? And then the government would be in a bind. It could not divulge how it had gotten that information. And so for several months after Brian Regan was arrested, prosecutors tried to dig up other evidence that could stand in court. And finally, there was a breakthrough in early 2002, when one of his computers, ended up being searched once again. It had been searched before, and the information that was on it had been missed. But you're right; the defense attorney, by virtue of trying to insist that the government leave these computers alone and not entered them into evidence, kind of tipped off the prosecution.
The attorney asked multiple times over the course of a couple days to leave that computer
yes.
alone, right?
Yes, and so that sort of made the prosecution suspicious as to what was on these computers, and the FBI decided to take a second look, a closer look. And once they did, they started finding these fragments of the same letter that they had intercepted. And finally, they were able to actually find the entire letter. And that's when they discovered that he hadn't simply sent this offer of his to the Libyans. He had also sent it to the Iraqis. And then he later admitted to also having sent it to the Iranians.
And what they found were the letters with the complete lack of spell check.
Yes. that should have been a clue, when they started finding the same spelling errors. What are the chances of somebody having written the same letter on their computer and made the same errors? Of course, it was clear, and this did stand up in court, even though the defense tried to inject some doubt and tried to question the chain of custody of these computers that had been seized, 6 months prior.
But Regan wouldn't give up. I mean, he was charged. He was convicted. He would not tell the government where all these secrets had been hidden. It wasn't until they went after his wife that he acceded to them.
Yeah, it was very sad, actually, the fact that he was so determined to try to prove that he would ultimately get the better of the government, that it was almost a suicidal move on his part to try to blackmail the government to begin with. And then even after his sentencing, you know, he wasn't really prepared, even after his conviction, he wasn't prepared to start cooperating. Now, Brian Regan had involved his wife in a cover-up plan while he was in prison awaiting trial. And his wife, who wanted to help him and believed that perhaps he was innocent, she didn't know any better, and so she fell for it. She started to go out into the woods and started to bury little McDonald's toys and some other innocent things to create an alibi for Regan. Of course, she didn't know that this was meant as an alibi. He had given her a different story. And so I think ultimately, once again, you know, when the government said, look, you know, we can now press charges against your wife, he decided that this was too much, that his whole family was going to get destroyed because of what he had done. And that's when he agreed to cooperate in exchange for a promise that the government wouldn't prosecute his wife.
His codes were uncrackable, so they needed him to help. Once he agreed to do that, he could crack the codes at the park in Virginia. But then when he tried to crack the codes at Patapsco Valley, he couldn't figure them out anymore.
Brian Regan was incredibly absent-minded and forgetful. I mean, he wrote notes to himself, you know, hundreds and hundreds of post-it notes with little, you know, scripts for how to run his morning, how to run his afternoon, because he very easily forgot things. And so it wasn't surprising to investigators. I mean, it was very alarming to them, but it wasn't surprising when he finally sat down with the code breaker from the FBI who was working on the case and said, you know what, I actually don't remember exactly how I wrote this code. And the fact was that he had written the codes for the Maryland packages, the ones in Patapsco, way before he had written the codes for the Virginia packages. So more than 3 years had passed since he had written these codes, and it was totally believable that he couldn't remember it. He had no reason to lie at this point. And that made the FBI's job even more difficult. And so we have this kind of strained situation toward the end of the book where the hunter and the hunted are sort of collaborating, trying to remember and trying to figure out how this code works.
In the end, they had to take him out to the park to try to figure out where the stuff was. They didn't want to let him out of custody. I mean, they didn't want to let him out of the building, but they had to because they just couldn't figure it out without him actually on site to figure out where this stuff had been hidden.
They couldn't figure it out because even with the decrypted coordinates for these hiding locations, you know, it turns out that GPS isn't so precisely accurate, so as to lead you to an exact point in the middle of a forest. You know, and there's factors like how much canopy there is. You know, there's factors like how much moisture there is in the air, which can vary, which can change the GPS readings from time to time. And so the government needed him to come out and actually lead them to these packages. And he was able to jog his memory once he was out in the forest. And the FBI investigators who were with him were absolutely, you know, they were amazed at the level of visual memory that he possessed. You know, he was almost savant-like in being able to lead them to the packages. It took more than one visit, but he was able to ultimately lead them to all of the packages in Maryland. And that's how you know, the investigators had initially just been making fun of Brian, kind of, you know, during the investigation, not making fun of him to his face, but, you know, as they discovered more and more of his gaffes, they found him to be a highly sort of comedic character. But then once he led them to these packages, and once they grasped everything that he had done for this plot to execute it, they had to admit that Brian Regan was brilliant in many ways, and it was this brilliance that was never recognized in his life, and I think that left him kind of wanting to prove that he had the smarts to do anything he wanted.
And he certainly did, although if he wasn't as careless as he was occasionally, he might have even gotten away with it.
You're right, Nathan. He might have.
Udijit Bhattacharjee's book is The Spy Who Couldn't Spell. It's a fast-paced book with all sorts of twists and turns. Thank you so much for spending the time to talk about it.
Thank you for having me on, Nathan.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR. When we get back, producer Rob Sivak will be taking over the host's chair, and we'll be chatting with theater critic J. Wynn Russick about American Hero, a dark comedy about a family trying to keep its small business afloat, now a rep stage in Colombia. That conversation in a moment. Stay tuned.